I am Kishori Charan Das, Oriya writer, and I'm recording from my works as part of South Asian Literary Recordings Project of the Library of Congress. I'll start by reading out a story originally written in Oriya named Bidharmi, which has been widely translated and published in many Indian languages and English. The translation, that is a recreation, has been made by me, and recently it has been included in the anthology known as Oriya Stories, brought out by Srishti, publishers and distributors of Delhi. This anthology carries writings from Fakir Mohan Senapati, Gopinath Mahanti, myself, that is Kishori Charan Das, and Manoj Das. This is one of the three stories included in this book. Godless, within bracket, Bidharmi, that is the Oriya title. I am not godless, not really. Anyone who knows me will accept the statement. Even Abhiram Babu has told me that all said and done, I possess a clean heart and I can love God. True, I can love him if he is like Abhiram Babu. But I know he is unlike him or anybody else. To put it straight, he does not exist. This is my conviction, and I did not have to change it now. But I am not godless. I am prone to greater affection than hate. I can never kill a person in fact or in imagination. I love the silent shimmerings of nature and the little creatures of the earth, the tremulous pool of water in the courtyard, the kitten in the basket licking his body all over in lazy time, the tender asvastha leaf emerging in fear and trembling from a crack in the wall, the fearless sparrow pecking at the mirror. I love all children. Do I not suffer so this moment from so much love? I have not met Abhiram Babu for a long time. Could it be that he doesn't want to see me? No, I do not think so. I have also not been able to make it, for I have no respite these days from office work. I shall go to his place next Sunday, I must, and I'll take my son along. The red rubber ball of my son has strayed to the rear end of the courtyard and is getting soaked in the rain. He is gazing at the ball. Seems as though he is soaking the thing. He is asking the thing to help him in his thoughts of the recent past. His thoughts are surely laced with my sorrows. I feel like telling him everything. He doesn't understand the divine stuff and can weep for me. I came to know Abhiram Babu about 1 year back when I moved to Calcutta. He works for the state government, but his office is close to mine in the adjoining wing of a three-storied building. We saw each other for the first time one day at the lunch hour on opposite sides of a greasy marble-topped table in the canteen on the ground floor. That was my trial visit to the canteen in a bid to cut down on expenses. But I was on the point of beating a retreat, thanks to the smoke, dirt and the sweating crowd, when I found an untouched plate of snacks placed before a gentleman engaged in deep meditation. The meditation over, he offered a portion of the food to his gods. He gave me an instant smile when he saw me and said, "Won't you be seated, please?" It was more curiosity than a desire to make friends. I sat on the chair opposite and noted, "Here is one of those god men." I have a strong prejudice against these people. Yet I was taken in by his bland smiles, untouched as it were by pleasure and the gentle unhurried words. I thought it may well be nice to have lunch with him once in a while in the canteen. you will not be bad company for half an hour on a tiring day. You will at least not intrude on my leisure by talking big and wise like many of my colleagues. Eventually, I found that he was not merely given to religion, he was also a lover of God. He would even get excited by hearing Ramdhun over the canteen radio. He would lose track of the conversation and would sometimes be lost entirely to the outside world, sitting there like an animated block of stone. Getting back to his senses, he would give the standard smile and offer apologies for being impolite. He may not be good-looking, but there is nothing apparently wrong in his features. A small frame, fair complexion, and a balding forehead would about sum up the general impression. He also comes to office neatly clad in a sober suit or trousers and boots like other officers. His gestures, manner of speech, and modes of laughter do not reveal any oddity either. On the whole, I found nothing in him that is apt to tickle you in your idle moments, except the certain weakness of an emotion that refuses to stay under cover, his love of God. He hardly talks about himself, but I wanted to take advantage of his good nature and get to the roots of his extraordinary goodness, extraordinary godliness. Most people in this world are on the side of God, but I have rarely come across such specimens of love for that invisible and unknown person. Those in whom I have noticed the aberration are the proclaimed saints and sadhus, or the illiterate non-beings of the countryside. They belong to alien worlds, not inhabited by sane, intelligent men like me and Abhiram Babu. So once I pounced on him. We were then standing somewhere in the Chaurangi Maidan on a July afternoon. The problem calling for urgent attention was to find a tram bound homeward which would allow us a reasonable foothold. Abhiram Babu was looking anxiously at the dark clouds. "What is the image of your God?" I asked him. The suddenness took him unawares, and he stared at me. I reframed the question for his benefit. "I mean, what is the image in which you happen to see him? Father, mother, friend, child, wife, mistress, or any other?" He ignored the sarcasm and answered as though giving a piece of information in his usual level tone. "I do not see God, I feel him." A tram not overly crowded at the footboard stopped near us at this moment, and we rushed to get inside, among others. We were able to plant our feet somehow on the available space, and were trying to keep steady with one hand clutching at the railing and the other clinging to the briefcase. Abhiram Babu found it possible to conclude his statement in this situation. "You know what I meant by feeling him?" I gathered myself completely. "It seems I do not have any wants. Not anymore." The conductor gave jostling among passengers to ask for the fare. I managed to bring out the coins with painful contortions and handed over the fare for both of us, whereas I noticed my companion holding his ground in an immobile posture, unmindful of the conductor. And then he laughed for no reason and said, "I remember a funny incident. Once I had closed my eyes at prayers. When I opened them, I found that my daughter Indu, sitting by my side, had also kept her eyes closed. She opened her eyes in a moment and smiled at me with her two upper teeth. That is all. As if we had got hold of some hidden treasure between ourselves. No one else was supposed to know about it." He laughed again and added, "She's a naughty one. Teases me all the time, but she loves me too much." Shortly he came to realize that he had not paid his tram fare and had indulged in unnecessary talk about himself. He offered the fare with apologies and fell into a long silence. I told him inwardly, "Your philosophy wears the mystic veil of words and ignorance. Never mind. I can see how you love your daughter. She is no god, but warm and living and real." I longed to meet that naughty little girl with a revealing pair of teeth. Her name was Chandrika, about 10 years ago, about 10 years of age. The two upper teeth, refusing to hide, were indeed cute. The nose was tilted upwards with a hint of a button, and the nostrils were definite. The thick hair was well and truly groomed in oil and turned back severely, as with village girls, to form a broad pigtail decked in red ribbon and marigold. She and my son came to be friends at first sight, so much so that my son could dare to snatch the flower in her pigtail after a few minutes, and Hindu ran after him in a fascinating mix of laughter and tears. Abhiram Babu had visited us with his family, and we are both enjoying this scene. "Why do you call her Hindu?" I asked him. "Her name is Chandrika, isn't it?" He must have been asked this question by many, for he appeared to settle himself nicely for the luxury of telling a twice-told yet vastly interesting tale. "You know what happened? She had a round face and a plump cheeks from the very beginning. So her mother and I decided that she must have something to do with the moon. She chose the name Chandrika and I preferred Indumati." The story was briefly stated, but it sought to give it the dimensions of an instructive episode, what with his enthusiasm and jest for detail. Very soon we came round to talk about other things. Abhiram Babu was back to his normal self, a peace-loving man of few words who finds everything basically good in the world. There is nothing particularly wrong with the policy of the government. However, the people have a reasonable cause for grievance. It's all a question of methods and procedures and will be sorted out in the near future. So-and-so is not really a bad person. One has to take into account the circumstances, etc. Muted comments, mild disclaimers, and an invocation to peace. Does it? Does not this man feel intensely about anything? Doesn't he suffer? Should he not be made to suffer like you and me, so that he can understand the facts of life? The moment passed, and I felt ashamed. He's a real God-man, I told myself, hence genuinely foolish. Meanwhile, the children were carrying on with their endless games. Sometimes my son joined Hindu in building a doll's house of stone and sand, forgetting that it was a girlish affair. And sometimes they were soon kicking and tossing the ball around like nobody's business. The big rubber ball seemed to hold a particular attraction for Hindu, for she was giving it a mighty kick now and then and shouting, "Goal!" The play gave over in a finale of thunder and lightning. The ball, driven powerfully by Hindu, hit my son on the nose and she burst out laughing. My son avenged the insult by eliminating the doll's house. As a result, both came running to their parents, flushed with anger, asking for instant redress. Well, we tried to diffuse the situation by petting and patting and holding out vague promises for the future. But they wanted results here and now. Abhiram Babu looked at his watch, and it seemed the best way out of the impasse was to call it a day. Then we heard the sing-song call to temptation. "The little boy will play, oh my little girl will play, the little boy," to the accompaniment of a music of sorts from the toys and dolls. My son pricked his ears, his eyes shone in anticipation. The toy man, he was a familiar figure in our neighborhood, but had not been much of a success to this boy's father. I had been able to keep him away from these noisy trinkets. These are cheap ones, girly stuff, etc. But now he seemed to be in hope, looking avidly back and forth. "Today you have a little boy, and also the little girl. Will you say no? Will you?" He could scarcely wait for the signal. He rushed out to greet the toyman with the Hindu in tow. The angry moments are forgotten. "Like the horse, look how he swings his tail. No, I'll take the bird, the one with the red beak. How about the frog? Ah!" The desired birds and animals were soon acquired. The bizarre sound of the music mingled with joyous laughter. Son and daughter, the little boy and the little girl, were equally happy. "When are you coming again?" I asked Hindu when they were about to leave. "Let him come first," said the lady, affecting a solemn tone. The young man nodded assent. The agreement was sealed by an expanding grin on both sides. They have not met each other since that day. I was meeting Abhiram Babu fairly often, but I could not visit him with my family. To start with, a certain laziness. Then they left for their village home on a vacation for 2 months. About a fortnight before the vacation was due to expire, there was a telephone call. The soft, slow syllables of her friend. Namaskar, we have come back. After a brief exchange of pleasantries, he said almost casually that Indu was not keeping fit, and that is why they had to shorten their stay in the village. I went directly to his place from my office that evening. Abhiram Babu was effusive in his welcome and treated him to the special sweets brought from home. I looked for Indu. Abhiram Babu said that she was in a bed with slight fever. His wife added that she seemed to have some peculiar illness. She was merely nibbling at her food and was getting thinner by the day. Abhiram Babu sought to tone down her concern by mildly negative gestures, as if it was not quite proper to impose the obligation of sympathy on another person. I did not like his attitude of otherness. Was not Indu a daughter to me? I said I would like to see her. Indu was sleeping. I found she had really become thin. I moved my palm caressingly around her forehead and offered the assurance that she would get well very soon. But there were no signs of her getting well. The fever did not subside. The city doctor was confirmed in his diagnosis that it was typhoid. He also said that several complications had set in, but there was no cause for anxiety. Yet, there was no noticeable change in the behavior of Abhiram Babu. He was coming to the office regularly, was having lunch in the canteen, was talking inoffensive politics, and was getting lost unpredictably in meditations. Once I even saw him offer his naive smile into the sick child when her mother tried to conceal her tears. The moon-faced Indu, her cheeks were still fairly round even as the body had sunk to a bare skeleton, answered him in the same token. As if they are playing the old game of communing each other after prayers. We know the score, you and me. Mother would not know, poor thing. Strange how they sought to relate in sadness. The scene called for abundant sympathy. More abundant than acute, for the sadness seemed to be so out of the world, almost inhuman, a bare idea of the limitless blue and the deep, where the bubbles say hello to each other. I did not like it. I looked for the sorrowing mother. She was my kind. I consoled her as best as I could. I said the doctor was banking on 50% hope and we could provide the balance with our prayers. I hastened to add that I was not referring to God. By prayers I meant the outpouring of emotions, the fear and fervent wish and all for the one we love. Does it not amount to something? Suddenly, my son changed the scenario. He caught fever. 2 days later, his body was full of sores. The doctor pronounced, without a moment's hesitation, that it was smallpox, raging like wildfire in the city. I must say I felt somewhat exalted when I passed on the news to Abhiram Babu. I have also been touched by tragedy. Let me have the appropriate awe and respect from you all. I beg to be excused for not being in a position to visit him for some time more and asked him not to come to my place so as to avoid infection. But in a few days, his condition became critical. I swept aside the beguiling veil of tragedy and I felt the raw pain, the pain of the living body, the 1,000 angry sores. They were torturing him with needles and red-hot metal. He was crying, my son. I tried to comfort him in the manner of Abhiram Babu. I tried to console his mother, but I could not control my own restlessness. I wanted to create or destroy something so that I could gather a sense of power and spread it like anodyne on his face. Once I saw the shadow of death in his eyes, No use asking the doctor. He would only nod his head like a knoll. Wait, let us see. That evening I could not bear the sight of that lighted room, laden with numerous bottles of medicine, the unceasing tears of his mother, the many orange peels and pomegranate seeds, and the pungent odor of the neem leaves. The excessive exercise to extend life seemed to be a cruel joke. Why suffer him to live if he has to die? And why keep him in death if he means to live? Why this prolonged agony of the seconds and minutes? I wanted to be left alone. I went to the rooftop. I surveyed the bright millions in the sky. Down below, I observed my fellow men. Somebody is searching his garage with a flashlight for a precious piece of property. Precious indeed. He doesn't know a thing about my son, nor does he care. Somewhere a glass window reveals the enjoyment of an evening, food and drink and company. Two men a burden are dragging on and on with a loaded cart. The sentry at the gate of the police barracks is counting stars. Prayers? Does it have to come to prayers at last? And I, one of those intellectual weaklings who demolish God by the logic of words and yet run to him for help at the sight of a ghost? I did not yield to temptation. I did not pray. I remembered Abhiram Babu. Indu and Abhiram Babu, he does not suffer like me, for he is safe in the cocoon of a lie. And then it came upon me that one of them will die. One of them will die so that the other may live. How do you smother a wish that overtakes you? How do you deny the passage of a shooting star? It is inconceivable that I bore him any malice, or that I did not love Indu like my own daughter. Yet I wished and believed that my son will recover, Indu will die. It will not hurt Abhiram Babu, for he is a man of God. That is how it should be. The men behind the glass window laughed a little too loudly, and all those men in view in houses and streets seemed to move at a faster pace and together. Even the racing cars and the sentry standing at his post appeared to be bound together in purpose and movement, like performers in a grand opera. Only I was not there. I was the outsider, godless. I went down the steps in a scare. I sat beside my son at the sick bed. His mother looked at me with tired eyes and asked, "Where have you been? There's a telephone call just now. Abhiram Babu." "What did he say?" My fear and anxiety did not reach her. She intoned listlessly. He enquired about our son and said that Indu has again taken a turn for the worse. There is hardly anything more to say. I could not go to see Indu on her last day. My wife was there. She told me that nobody knows if Abhiram Babu wept for his daughter, for he shut himself inside a room for hours and was looking normal with no trace of tears on his face when he came out. That is what I had imagined. I have no cause for remorse. For do they mean to say that my sorrow is a mere luxury of the aftermath, the pretense of not being able to heave the sigh of relief? That man will pass by in my lane any time now, or he may not, but I hear him toll the bell constantly, unreasonably, in my working hours. The little boy will play. Oh, my little girl will play. I shall not buy anything from him ever.